Salutations, my name is Omar Aline and you are listening to A Culture Made of Algorithms, the podcast that takes a look at our media consumption, the culture they produce and the societies left behind. Today, we're using the Hamilton Commission's report into racism, diversity and inclusion in motorsport to examine the great white myth, or that the idea that white people, because they're white, are the benchmark of greatness, in order to showcase how a media product can encourage us to reinforce negative stereotypes. So what is the Hamilton Commission and why is it looking at motorsport and F1 more specifically? Well, the commission is chaired by and is named after the seven-time and current world champion, as Formula One world champion, Lewis Hamilton, the only driver in the sport who is black, a status which he has carried uninterrupted for his entire 15 years in the sport. But what's F1 and why is his status of being the only black driver so special? Well, F1 began back in the 1920s and 30s as a technical exercise for European drivers and manufacturers who wanted to experiment with the emerging technology that was the automobile. Starting off as a series of organized events, the very early roots of F1 are occupied by individuals with the wealth and free time to not only own cars, but have the time and funds and knowledge to replace broken parts, research new ones, and even develop the reliability of the existing technology. And in the world before, you know, 0.02p plastics or 3D printers or £30 EasyJet flights and £100 Eurotunnel crossings, the sport attracted and necessitated international elites and their funding. And quite literally, royal princes, united sirs and lords of lands were quite literally some of the names and titles being given and already held by drivers and car owners who made up the early grid. Now, once World War II ended, 1946 saw the rules which made Formula One standardized, and in 1950, the sport became a world championship. And in becoming a world championship, it broadened its racing calendar to places beyond Europe for the first time in a consistent manner. Now, this actually attracted a wider range of international elites, you know, through the development of the transport technologies, of post-war technological innovations and development, as well as international appeal, the cost of F1 seemed to have stayed the same, only eligible to the most wealthy. But because more people had more access to money, i.e. those who had made their money through investments during the war, the cost of some things like sheet metal came down. And so F1 seemed to now be accessible in a new way to new people while still being just as inaccessible as it always had been. And so previously, where we had seen monarchy and those who, well, took up high ranking statuses in our societies, it was now open to the upper middle class rather than just the monarchs. But fundamentally, despite these changes and developments, it did very little to change the demography of the sport. The people who had access to funds before the war were mostly the same type of person who had access to money after the war. Now, this, coupled with the growing interest of automotive manufacturers and marketing arms of luxury product manufacturers, it meant money was being poured into the sport, which now had a business interest rather than a hobbyist one. And as such, an international business expectation came with it. Now, with this wealth and access to wealth being key components of the sport and are argued to be such a core component that explains why even grassroots motorsport requires incredible amounts of wealth and access to capital, motorsport can't be considered a grassroots sport in the same way that football or rugby or basketball might be, simply because it requires more things to get involved. You know, football requires what? A patch of grass, maybe a bit of concrete, a ball that you can buy which is commercially available, and a few friends. Motorsport, on the other hand, requires engineering expertise, access to metal and welding, the ability to buy a motor, an engine, to fabricate chassis for a go-kart, to buy fireproof materials for your race suit, to be able to purchase and decorate potentially a helmet, to travel to locations where you aren't just driving on pieces of grass, but dedicated pieces of private land that make up racetracks. And so with racetracks comes maintenance in both the tarmac and maybe timing equipment, trophies and how these things are formulated and organized. Motorsport isn't as cheap as other sports are. And when you map these historical trends of who has access to wealth, who requires wealth to participate in the sport, and who was wealthy at the time, as well as when you map it against reach, the brand appeal, and the financial demand necessary, you begin to see who and where these overlaps become to reach. You begin to see who gets admitted, namely low-income households, those from disenfranchised communities, and, well, media villains, quite frankly. And I mean that in the case of this person is an archetype for a villain, whether that could be, well, once upon a time, Russians during the Cold War, people from the Middle East during the early 2000s. And you begin to see that, well, motorsport isn't for everyone, simply because of the costs involved. So, yes, if I am going to make a cliche this episode, Formula One was a straight, rich, white man sport. But let's hold on a second. That isn't a moral judgment or a moral stain on the sport. See, Formula One, like all sports, can only exist within the socio-economic climate which enable it to exist. Before the invention of the automobile, motorsport and Formula One could never exist. And so, once an emerging technology came in, we have to acknowledge that those who had access to invest in this emerging technology were those who were able to participate within it. In requiring this initial investment, quite literally, Formula One then grew off the back of, well, let's be honest, the idea that the biggest brains also came from those with the highest income sources. And for a long time, it meant that only rich white men, or unless you were a monarch from some other faraway but still relatively wealthy land, were the only ones with the income streams and educations and niche interest and connections to invest in the sport. The problem, however, is that in creating a sport whose culture is falsely built on the belief that because you're rich and white, you must be the best. And this is how Lewis Hamilton came in and disrupted the trend. Ethnically, he isn't white. Financially, he wasn't rich. There are stories of his father quite literally asking for, and sometimes even rummaging through, the bins of discarded tyres that other people threw away, his competitors threw away. And in using their throwaway parts, Lewis Hamilton was able to participate in the sport in a way that was a little bit less demanding. There are stories of how they've had to live out of the van temporarily, in which they were traveling across Europe and the UK to participate in races at the level appropriate levels. There are also stories of Anthony Hamilton, Lewis Hamilton's father, remortgaging the home, and yes, remortgaging, which meant that even in the most poorest of circumstances, access to capital, in this case real estate capital, is what enabled Lewis Hamilton to get his start. And eventually he too began to fit into the mold in which manufacturers funded these automobile events. And that's how Lewis Hamilton really got his big break through McLaren, the technology partner and motorsport business. Now, Lewis Hamilton, it might be regarded as the first full-time driver, but he wasn't the only one. 20 years before him, in 1986, Willie T. Ribbs almost became the first black driver. In this case, he only managed to facilitate a test, but through some other political shenanigans, Willie didn't make the cut then. And so we see that not much had changed since 1986. Fundamentally, Willie missed out on a drive because he wasn't Italian. Lewis Hamilton could only get his drive because he was affiliated with a motorsport manufacturer. And since Lewis Hamilton's debut in 2007, no one else has managed to follow him through. And so the Hamilton Commission becomes very interesting reading. Because fundamentally, like I pointed out earlier, Formula One is a reflection of a highly condensed socioeconomic demographic and environment. Its talent pool in order to get into Formula One is a subsection of people rather than the entirety fabric of a nation society, which is then skimmed for the very best. See, Formula One has the potential right now to fall over itself by ignoring emerging and developing talent because they're not from the areas Formula One typically looks into to recruit. And so, where education has now become more accessible, where financial access has become more accessible, where capital growth has become more accessible, Formula One isn't used to looking in these areas. And as such, the report has had to take the industry to town. As Hamilton himself writes in the foreword of the report, quote, "There are 7 F1 teams in the UK and over 4,000 companies. That's a lot of jobs. From drivers to engineers, managers to accountants. There are suppliers and sponsors who hire thousands of people a year. If there are so many jobs and so many different paths in this industry, why do we see so few black people? The answer is our industry is set up to attract a certain type of person from a certain type of background and certain economic status. It seems as if our industry says, no, not you. And in our wider society, it seems that, all too often, kids like me get told they're not good enough, don't get to see their potential, don't think they can achieve their dreams." End quote. In quite a reflective way, Hamilton sees his lonely experience in F1 and asks, is my isolation curated or an unfortunate coincidence? If so, why and how do we change it? Now, granted, that foreword is a massive spoiler as to what the findings of the report eventually become, but we're still going to talk about it briefly. Now, why? Well, because in being a media product, as well as a sporting one, as well as an engineering one, Formula One has created a brand around making a case that it is the best. And because brands often reflect values and through technological determinist frameworks such as media ecology, we know that these values, perpetuated through media products, are often internalized by their audience, who then reflect it within their wider society. As such, Formula One's ideological and practical shortcomings can be reproduced in our wider society. If somebody wants to make a case they are the best, wants to investigate what the best is, or wants to know what the best looks like. But what are these beliefs? Well, to uncover that, we actually have to read the report, funnily enough. And this is what the Hamilton Commission discovered. Now, in their report, which briefly takes the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics sectors, better acronymized to being STEM, to town, the Hamilton report investigates everything from educational imbalances and teaching influence to hiring practices and workplace culture. In dissecting how one would get into F1, the motivations you might receive on your way, as well as investigating what life is like once you're there, the report finds several areas where coincidental discrimination has grown into systemic abuse. For example, in page 16, quote, "Formula One and wider motorsport teams rely heavily on data to improve performance. Yet across most organizations engaged in this commission, there was almost no data available on the ethnicity of the workforce. From interviews across the sector, we estimate the proportion of black people in Formula One to be less than 1%, end quote. This means Formula One is shown to have a sort of taken for granted approach for when it comes to the talent, where they're recruiting and how. In the makeup of Formula One being so, well, homogenous, we discovered that rather than pursuing new elements and finding where new greatness might be lurking and growing, F1 seems to rely on the same tried and true practices that have worked for them before. This means that when we look at it as a media product, we're not looking at Formula One as an emerging technology which is seeking out the greatest and the next best personnel as it does its materials. We're seeing potentially some people that could be regarded the best who are then looking out for some of the best things out there." Now, further down on page 16, it talks about recruitment here, and it says, quote, "Formula One teams often recruit graduates with first-class honours degrees and, more often than not, graduates who have studied at a few elite universities, a select group of the UK's highest, ranked research-intensive universities, from which many of the existing engineers and recruiting managers within teams also graduated." Now, this means that Formula One has unfortunately internalized some unfortunate misgivings from the education sector, which we know through investigations as recently as 2018, have racist hiring practices. For example, in a report discovered that in the UK, black people were 21 more times more likely to have a university application investigated, as opposed to typically taken at face value. In being targeted for investigation and targeted for weaknesses in their application, we managed to find reasons to exclude black people from these elite universities. The report even shows that this is a continued issue, recognizing that the higher education sector has inherited a discriminatory practice from secondary education also. As the report shows, Streaming or setting of young black students is typically done into lower ability groups for mathematics and science based on, quite frankly, low teacher expectations. This then goes on to limit the child's ability to achieve the top grades at GCSE, which in turn reduces the opportunities they are allowed to take mathematics or physics at A level. To translate this for those who haven't gone through the UK education system, SETs are a form of classroom division in which the best students all end up in one class, the second best up in another class, and depending on the size of the school, these can typically range between set 1 and set 8. Within these sets, GCSE tests are then attributed based on higher or lower papers. This matters because if you take a lower paper, you can only get a C grade maximum on that paper you may be taking. Whereas if you take a higher paper, you are able to achieve the greatest possible exam results as an A star, or which I believe is now a grade 1 or a grade 8, depending on what year it currently is. Interestingly enough, though, these sets aren't always attributed based on academic prowess. You can potentially be in set 1 without having ever done a test to get into your GCSE set. It can be based purely on teacher predictions. And so if your teacher doesn't anticipate you being a fantastic student for whatever reason, again, if this isn't scientifically or if this isn't objectively based reasons, research or reasoning, then you could potentially be capped at from ever achieving the greatest grades and going on to live a fulfilled life as an F1 mechanic simply because a teacher doesn't like you. The report also examines how even if you manage to avoid these obstacles, there is then a geographic recruitment pool process which can hold you back. For example, quote, a key challenge for many young people interested in joining the sector, particularly at younger apprentice ages, is the geographical location of many of the businesses in rural parts of the country within Motorsport Valley. That is a registered trademark, by the way, with limited public transport infrastructure in the area. Opportunities are often restricted to local young people or those who are able to relocate, whilst the vast majority of young black people live in major cities across the UK, such as London, Birmingham, and Manchester, end quote. This report becomes so specific to the challenges facing those trying to get into F1, and quite often these are difficulties which have nothing to do with the potential hiree or student on their way to the top. It means that F1 not only regurgitates some damaged stereotypes, it also inherits them. This combination has led F1 to a tricky relationship with diversity and inclusion. So, yeah, imagine you've managed to avoid every pitfall placed up to you until now. You've managed to not only achieve the greatest grades, you've not only managed to relocate to Motorsport Valley. There's now another challenge facing you. The report now talks about employment in this sector. So as the report explains, black engineering graduates are less likely to have progressed into engineering roles. Around 35% who graduate manage to work in engineering, compared to white engineering graduates who graduate around 57%. It also finds that black engineering graduates are also twice as likely to be unemployed, 14% likely to be employed, compared to white counterparts who 7% of white engineering graduates are to be unemployed. This differential transition into engineering employment is troubling and suggests that employers in engineering generally need to scrutinize the recruitment processes and practices, end quote. What it talks about here is that potentially after avoiding every pitfall placed in front of you, it's now your turn to get a job in engineering. Engineering is what Formula One hires for. And even then, the chances of you being employed aren't fantastic. And so now we're looking at very specific discriminatory practices which exist within F1. What's interesting here is that the people who would be going into these roles have to have an interest in Formula One. And the report looks at this as well. Talking about role models, it says, finally, the primary research showed that although Lewis Hamilton was seen by many respondents as a strong role model for young black people and ranked highly as someone young people look up to, few young people follow or watch motorsport in their free time, which is also a barrier to engagement with the careers in the sector. Now, this has been a discussion which has come up several times in recent weeks as Formula One continues to double down on its paywall practices. It means that even if you are a prospective engineering graduate, the odds of you actually watching motorsport through various difficulties, quite often in this case it's to do with cost, means you will never be able to engage in the sport in a way that meaningfully impacts you so that you may want to pursue it intentionally. That it also poses a difficulty if you come from a low income household, for example, the funds necessary to invest or to pay for a Sky Sports Formula One package is significantly lower than those who come from a high income household and who have those disposable income and assets available to spend that money on monthly subscription year after year. So where am I going with all of this? Well, the long story short, motorsports is in a dark position. And unless it changes quickly, it may end up ignoring some of the greatest talent which is yet to be tapped. But more relevant to this episode, we can begin to see how a brand can internalize and encourage dangerous misconceptions because we only see that final product. Now, what I mean by that is when we see F1 come into town or a country, we see race teams and drivers, aka only a very small fraction of what makes up the finished product. We don't see the people working at the factory, those who worked in logistics, who may now be preparing for the next race, who have left early in order to make sure that's possible. And whilst this is fine and very similar to many other types of sport, you know, we don't see the physio usually of a football team. We don't see the kit man of a football team. Being able to see only a very small fraction of the finished product be somewhat homogenous, as I spoke about earlier, we then associate greatness with the small fraction we are able to see. In doing so, when we watch these sorts of products, we begin to see them symbolized. And because symbols are analyzed now, I'm not saying everyone does semiotic analysis in their free time, but we are able to see that when a symbol is given to us, we look at them somewhat intensely in order to see if we understand what it's trying to say. And depending on how someone may analyze a symbol, depending on their own biases, they may be likely to agree or disagree with what that symbol is implying. In this case, Formula One symbolizes greatness, but it also symbolizes greatness through whiteness, implicitly, accidentally, but also a little bit intentionally. If you really want to scrutinize its hiring and educational support practices, frequently we see internalization come out as expectation, and we can see this in F1's fan base. Just looking at the criticism of the Hamilton report, we see people call this a fictionalized witch hunt, that F1 is hiring the best and it just so happens that these people are white. Others take on a more literal interpretation to say that motorsport is only for white people because white people are the ones who are able to get into the best universities, a statement which ignores the biases in higher education, as well as the ones higher education has inherited from secondary and tertiary education centres. But I hope you can begin to see what I'm attempting to say. That is, when we see a finished product on our television screens, we often imagine that we see all of the work. We think we know what it's like to work for these industries. We think we know what it's like to get into the top teams, whether that's in Formula One or even in football. We imagine that because they're there, they've entirely deserved it, and most likely they have. However, we don't know the challenges which have faced those who failed to get there. Quite often, these failures aren't the fault of those who failed. They can be the fault of those who don't want to see these people succeed. Formula One is no different. And in seeing how it's so similar to other sports, I hope you're able to see how this might impact the sports you are more familiar with as well. Accessibility in this case is not just in the final product, it has to go into all the ingredients which get us there. So thank you very much for listening. My name's Omar Aline. You can catch the podcast on social media. You can find the podcast on Twitter as @ACMOAPod. You can also find me personally on Twitter and Instagram as @OmarAline. If you enjoy the podcast, make sure to follow and leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening, and I shall see you in a future episode. But until then, keep consuming, consider the culture it's creating and the society which you hope to leave behind. Take care. Bye bye.